This episode is brought to you by Curie Briefs, the smartest 3-minute read in medicine. Think of it like mental floss for busy clinicians. Sharp, concise, and clinically relevant. Check it out today at Curie.md. And now, on to the show.
Hey, Curie listeners. On today's episode, we're talking about a story that's been making a lot of noise lately and capturing a lot of headlines, and that is the story linking acetaminophen use or Tylenol use during pregnancy with autism. And I've been reading the coverage and looking at some of the studies and been watching the various political reactions in response to the story. And the more that I sat with it, the more I felt like there are a few big reflections here and some musings and thoughts that I can't just seem to shake. So I wanted to share them with you all, and rather than try to build some grand narrative arc, I thought, hey, let's just do kind of a six pack of ideas, six things that stuck and struck me about this controversy. And so here are six thoughts that have kind of been swirling around my head, and maybe it'll help you make sense of the noise as well. All right, so let's start with the basics. What do we actually know? And on the question of whether taking Tylenol during pregnancy causes autism, there's no evidence showing a clear causal relationship. There are observational studies that have found some associations. So some show a very small increase in risk. We're talking about, 5 to 20% higher odds. But those kinds of studies, those kinds of observational studies can be a little messy. They pick up other factors like genetics or even a shared environment. And so the best study that we have on this is probably a big sibling comparison study that came out of Sweden. And it looked at about 2.5 million kids over 2 decades. And essentially, here's what they did. So if a mom took Tylenol during one pregnancy for one of their kids, but for not the other, they then compared the outcomes between those two siblings. And when you control for genetics and family factors like that, the association basically disappears. So very little data to support the idea that Tylenol itself is causing autism. And we know that correlation doesn't necessarily imply causation in some of those observational studies that did show a small increase in risk. And that's also the view of most major health authorities. So the UK's regulatory agency came out and said that they still recommend Tylenol acetaminophen during pregnancy when it's used as directed. And ACOG, the big American OBGYN group, also said something similar and reaffirmed its safety when used appropriately. On the other side, just to give some credibility or credence to that argument, there was a review published recently that looked at 46 studies and argued we should warn pregnant people about the potential risks. But since then, that paper's methodology has been criticized, and even the authors admit that the evidence is quite mixed when you start to blend 46 studies with different types of methodologies and study designs and study structures. So if we're just being objectives, sure, there are some studies that show associations, but the best designed ones don't find causation, and health agencies have not changed their guidance on Tylenol use during pregnancy. So that's the baseline. That's where this whole debate starts. Moving on to reflection number two, I wanted to talk about this story in the context of incentives, or really the lack thereof. Because when I started reading more about this story, what became very, very clear is that one of the biggest reasons this debate exists in the first place is structural. Nobody has a big financial reason to even settle this debate. You know, Tylenol is one of the oldest generic drugs out there. It's cheap and it's essentially everywhere. And there is really no company with a huge financial upside that's going to say, hey, let's fund a massive randomized controlled trial with tens of thousands of pregnant women over a decade. And if you compare that to a new drug, and when a company develops a new drug and submits an application and looks for approval from the FDA, they have to do those kinds of studies. It's how they get approved by this governing body. There are regulatory incentives, commercial incentives, legal incentives, all designed to generate clean, accurate data. But for older drugs like Tylenol that were approved before this system existed, the science kind of just stalls out, and you get a lot of observational studies, maybe from academic groups who might have very limited funding, and maybe you get a meta-analysis here and there, but there isn't anything really definitive to answer questions like these. And it's the same story with leucovorin, by the way. And that's the whole other part of this saga, the idea that leucovorin might help some kids with autism. And, you know, there are a couple of small promising studies, but we're talking about sample sizes of, you know, 80 kids and 24 weeks. So really just a slight bump in verbal scores. It's interesting, yes, but definitive, absolutely not. And again, no one's funding kind of these big follow-up trials. So the evidence kind of just sits in this awkward middle place. So if you're wondering, why don't we just run a big study and figure this out, figure out the link between Tylenol, the potential link between Tylenol during pregnancy and autism, and if leucovorin is a potential solution to that, the answer is there's no one who's really incentivized to do it. And that's not some dark conspiracy theory. It's just how the economics of medicine work. So let's move on to reflection or musing number three here. And this is where things get a little spicy, because when you have that kind of scientific vacuum, when the data is inconclusive, the studies are small, and the incentives to get better data just aren't there, guess who has the opportunity to step in? Politicians. And that's exactly what happened here. At that White House press conference a couple of weeks ago, Trump and RFK Jr. basically took this kind of fuzzy, unsettled body of evidence and presented it like it was a done deal. Like, yeah, Tylenol is dangerous and you should avoid it during pregnancy. And to be clear, that's not what the science says. And we discussed that a little bit earlier. That's not what the regulatory agents say, but it is a great political narrative. And it taps into this larger story that RFK Jr. and the whole MAHA movement have been pushing. And this is the idea that big corporations and the medical establishment have been hiding the truth for decades. And Tylenol then becomes the perfect villain. It's old, it's everywhere. It kind of has a little bit of a messy history. And people already have this very strong suspicion of the pharma industry. And so politics rush in, they fill that vacuum, and suddenly this very nuanced and unsettled scientific question turns into a culture war, and a war being played out amongst headlines. And you see everyone else kind of scrambling, you know, agencies putting out statements, regulators trying to clarify their guidance, researchers going on TV, going on social media to clarify their message. And it turns out to be this whole chaotic, very reactive social media storm. And to me, that's one of the clearest lessons in this whole story. When science doesn't close the loop, somebody else will. And usually that somebody is politics. So number four, this one I've been thinking about a lot. And It's an idea that we tend to assume the oldest drugs, the ones that, you know, have been around forever, the ones that everyone's taken, and the ones that, you know, your mom probably gave you when you were a kid. We tend to assume that the oldest drugs are the ones that we understand the best. You know, it's Tylenol. How much more is there really to kind of figure out? But in truth, it's kind of the opposite. A lot of these older drugs were approved decades ago and long before modern regulatory standards were in place. And, you know, once they're kind of out in the world, there's no real push to keep studying them. And so the science around them kind of just freezes in time. And Tylenol is a perfect example of that. You know, in Tylenol, it was first introduced in the 1950s, and it was kind of this, you know, little syrup for kids. And they marketed it as an elixir for little hotheads in a fire truck shaped box. But as you get into the 60s and 70s, you know, suddenly doctors realize that in high enough doses, this supposedly gentle children's painkiller can absolutely wreak havoc on your liver. And we're not talking just a little, we're talking fatal overdoses. And, you know, especially in the UK, Tylenol became one of the most common drugs involved in suicide attempts. Fast forward to the early 1980s, there is an infamous tampering scare. So somebody had laced Tylenol capsules with cyanide, and unfortunately, 7 people died as a result. And there was a nationwide panic, and Johnson & Johnson had to do a massive recall. And they basically invented tamper-proof packaging because of that. So over and over, this drug that everyone thought they fully understood kept revealing new dimensions about itself. And unfortunately, sometimes through tragedy, these dimensions revealed themselves. And it's not necessarily because the molecule changed itself, but the attention changed. And that's kind of the paradox that I spoke to earlier. The older a drug gets, the less attention it gets, and the more likely it is that there are blind spots just sitting there. And that's why Tylenol is such, I think, fertile ground for controversy now. It's everywhere. It's old, it's cheap. But there are also these little gaps in its scientific record. And it's not that there's some dark secret conspiracy theory waiting to be uncovered. It's more that this is just kind of the normal, slow, boring process of scientific scrutiny moving on. And what's left behind are essentially these pockets of uncertainty that are easy to then turn into stories. So yeah, that is the legacy drug paradox. The drugs that we think we know best are often the ones that we actually know the least about. So let's move on to number 5 here, switching gears and talking a little bit about leucovorin. And, you know, what's actually interesting about leucovorin is I kind of view it as a mirror image of the Tylenol story. So with Tylenol, you've got this old generic drug and a cloud of suspicion forming around this drug. But with leucovorin, it's kind of the opposite. You've got this new wave of optimism building off some pretty limited and pretty flimsy studies. Here's the kind of the backstory on leucovorin. It's a form of folinic acid, and it's been around for a while, used in other indications for several years now. But there's some intriguing research suggesting that it might improve verbal abilities in some kids with autism, particularly those with folate pathway abnormalities. So there are a few studies and a few studies showing modest improvements, but we're talking about, you know, 1 or 2 point improvements on a standardized 60-point scale. And these studies are double blind, randomized. So certainly legit, but they're also very, very small. 80 kids, just one center, only about 24 weeks. So like I mentioned earlier, yeah, promising, certainly, but definitive, absolutely not. But yeah, the political machine has kind of kicked Luke O'Vorin into gear, and HHS is now talking about expediting Luke O'Vorin for broader use in autism-related indications, and it's kind of this natural villain versus hero story in which we're painting Tylenol as the villain and Luke O'Vorin as the savior, as the hero. And you can already start to kind of see some of the ripple effects. Parents asking pediatricians about it. Insurers starting to look at coverage. Advocacy groups starting to pick it up. And, you know, I think this is where things can get very, very tricky. Because, you know, hope is a very powerful drug. And, you know, when you're a parent or a caretaker of someone with autism, a child with autism, and you hear that there's, you know, a supplement, one that's cheap and relatively accessible that might improve language abilities, of course you're going to be interested. I mean, who wouldn't be? But if we zoom out, what's happening here is there's thin evidence. What's happening here is that there is a thin evidence base. And that thin evidence base is being operationalized very, very fast. There's political will, there's public demand for Luke O'Vorin, and really nothing standing in its way. And so this thing has kind of taken a life on its own. Luke O'Vorin has kind of taken a life on its own before the science has had a chance to really catch up. And it's... To me, I think this is a reminder of how quickly and how easily the pendulum can swing from, you know, we don't know enough about this drug to, hey, let's run with it as a potential solution, as a potential solve for autism. So if the Tylenol story is about weaponizing uncertainty, to me, the Luke O'Vorin story is about weaponizing hope. And both can happen and both can be true at the same time. All right, so reflection number 6. I want to end on something a little bit different because as I was reading through all of these stories, all of these headlines, all of these hot takes, all of these social media threads, I kept coming back to this idea that the way a study is designed really matters and really matters a lot. And I know a lot of our clinicians listening to this episode know this, and you don't necessarily need to be an epidemiologist to spot some of the differences. But, you know, even if we take that Swedish study I mentioned earlier, the one that used a sibling comparison design, such a smart way to control for all of the messy family level stuff, the genetics, the environment, the shared exposures that can muddy the waters in certain trial designs. And, you know, when they use this sibling comparison design, the Tylenol Association during pregnancy, the Tylenol Association with autism basically disappeared. But on the flip side, you have these meta-analyses and observational studies that don't do that kind of control, and they show modest association, and then you have journalists or politicians picking those numbers up, slapping them onto a headline, and suddenly it sounds like there's a smoking gun here. And so, you know, the quick tip that I took away from this saga is when you see a study being cited, you should really ask yourself a few simple questions. You know, how big is the study? What's the design? Who funded it? And, you know, does the conclusion actually match the strength of the evidence? You don't have to go into full detective mode here, but kind of just doing that little bit of mental triage, I think, can really help you sort signal from noise. So, Yeah, let's wrap this up here. You know, just to recap, we started with the facts, you know, what the science actually said, what the science actually says and doesn't say about Tylenol and autism. We talked about incentives and how nobody's really funding these big definitive studies. We talked about how politics rush in to fill those gaps. And we also talked about how the oldest drugs are often the least understood. And we looked at leucovorin and how hope can run ahead of evidence. But to me, you know, the big takeaway, if I were to sum up some of these reflections in just a few quick sentences here, to me, the big takeaway is this. Stories like this one aren't really about the molecules themselves. They're about the narrative. And when the science is unsettled and unclear, somebody is going to fill in those blanks. Maybe that somebody is politicians, maybe it's the media, maybe it's advocacy groups, or just the collective imagination. So that is my six-pack of reflections on the Tylenol controversy. I hope you enjoyed this episode and want to thank you for listening. And we hope to see you next time on the Curie Podcast.